This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Tom Clancy, Enemy Contact by Mike Madden. Read for you by Scott Brick. Out in Weenium, Weum, out Facium, I shall find a way, or make one. Chapter 1. Partido de Bahía Blanca, Argentina. He was a scorpion. First Ensign Salvio was never more proud of that fact than now. He checked his watch. 3 minutes to target. Like his men, he was kitted out in body armor, a leg-holstered Glock 17 pistol, an M4A1 carbine, and a ballistic ATE Kevlar helmet with night vision goggles. The noise of the whining twin turboshafts of the EC-145 Eurocopter filled the dimly lit cabin. His platoon of special operators of Grupo Alacrán, Scorpion Group, was the best unit in the Gendarmería Nacional Argentina, maybe the whole country. Grupo Alacrán was Argentina's primary anti-terror weapon, like Israel's Yamam, the elite police unit with whom Salvio's team had trained in the Ayalon Valley. His men were the bleeding tip of the spear. Salvio flashed 3 fingers to his trusted number 2, Sergeant Adjutant Acuña, who acknowledged with a nod and a feral grin. The two of them cut their teeth fighting armed mafia gangs and Islamic radicals in La Triple Frontera, the border region where Brazil, Paraguay, and Argentina collided. Long a bastion of drugs, guns, and human trafficking by international and indigenous gangs, the region's violence and crime grew worse each year. The Lebanon Civil War drove tens of thousands of Lebanese to the region, and with them, Hezbollah. And with Hezbollah came Iran. Hell, even Osama bin Laden and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had visited La Triple Frontera years ago. His government couldn't root them out, couldn't even stem the tide. But after OBL appeared on scene, American money and technology fluttered in and brought the war on terror to La Triple Frontera. Kept the cancer contained for a few years. But then the Americans turned their attention elsewhere, and now Hezbollah was on the move again. South. Tonight's mission was proof of that. GNA intelligence had spotted a Lebanese Hezbollah commander 2 days ago, and CIA confirmed. But the CIA confirmation yesterday of an actual Iranian Quds Force commander on the ground near the coastal city of Bahía Blanca put blood in their mouths. Against his government's protests, a gathering of Hasidic youth in Bahía Blanca was scheduled for next week. Hundreds of young Jewish people from all over the country would attend. A perfect target. And an Iranian Quds Force commander to lead the attack. Hezbollah had killed in his country before. More than 100 Jews in 2 separate bombing attacks in the 90s. And they'd promised to do it again. The 2 terrorists were holed up at a small abandoned horse ranch just 26 kilometers north of the city. Capture them, alive, was his only order, straight from the mouth of the Comandante Mayor. A chance to finally break the Hezbollah network, he said, and to knock the bastard Iranians back on their heels. So they saddled up at their base in Ciudad Evita, loading out 3 helicopters with 23 of his best troopers. The 3 Eurocopters took 3 different flight vectors, avoiding direct routes from the base to the target. He was pushing the EC-145 range limit to the maximum, but there was no point in making it easy for any shoulder-fired manpads the Tangos might have with them. His aircraft would need a refuel for the flight back for sure. 2 minutes out, the pilot said in Salvio's headset. He glanced around the cabin. Terabini, Gallardo, Zanetti, Crispo, Berkner, Herman. His boys were young but well-trained, good shooters and duros. They met his eyes with confident smiles. They were like hungry wolves in a pack. His pack. Kill the lights, he told the pilot. The dim red bulbs extinguished. Salvio switched his comms channel. Bravo 1, this is Alpha 1, sit rep. His sniper team, a shooter and spotter posted 1 kilometer away in the flat open field surrounding the ranch, replied. Eyes on, no movement, lights out. Good to go, sir. ETA 90 seconds, Salvio said, adding in English, "Stay frosty." He logged off. Like every other Argentinian man his age, he grew up on American movies, but it was his black hat jump instructor at Fort Benning who'd first barked that order at him. Time to rock and roll. Based on drone surveillance photos shot the day before, Salvio ordered the pilots to put down in a NATO Y formation at 12, 4, and 8 o'clock relative to the broken-down main house. The only trees in the area were a few dense mesquites surrounding the house, partially blocking the view of the windows. Fence rails were down in several places, and a few ramshackle outbuildings were scattered around the now horseless ranch that had seen better days. Each Eurocopter flared in near-perfect sync to just a meter above the hard-packed dirt 100 meters from the house. Salvio jumped first. His men followed, boots hitting the ground on a dead run. The choppers roared away and took up overwatch, circling high and wide as the Scorpion operators raced toward the main house. Beneath the moonless blue-black sky, the ancient farmhouse was a gray shadow. Salvio landed at the 4 o'clock. He whispered orders into his comms for the advance of the rest of his team, knowing full well his men could do it without him. "Bravo One, we're on the ground," Salvio said. "Watch your fire." "We have your back, sir." The sniper team was positioned at 6 o'clock, the big Barrett M95 directly opposite the front door, ready to put a 50-caliber BMG slug through any cabron that stepped into its night vision glass. Salvio's squad advanced at a slow, crouching trot, as did the others. Out in the open on the flat, grassy plains, there was little chance of finding cover, so dropping in close was the only choice. He'd chosen the night, hoping the fighters inside didn't have night vision capabilities. The 24 troopers closed in rapidly from three directions, weapons high, rounds chambered, safeties off. Heavy boots thudded onto the rickety wraparound porch, where the squads split up, stacking on either side of windows and both doors, front and back. Flashbangs were pulled. Salvio took the front door. Arab music blared from a tinny radio inside. He whispered another order into his comms. Flashbangs crashed through window glass in six places simultaneously. The men closed their eyes and opened their mouths just as the grenades detonated. Doors crashed open under their boots and scorpions poured through into darkened rooms. The tactical light on Salvio's Glock 17 illumined the living room, as did the swiftly panning lights on the carbines around him. "Clear!" one of his sargentos shouted from the back of the house. Other shouts of clear soon followed. Soon Acuna appeared, disappointment in his flashlit eyes. "All clear, sir. Nobody's home." Salvio swore as he holstered his pistol. Where the hell were these bastards? "Aquí!" a man shouted from the kitchen. Salvio and Acuna dashed in. Private Gallardo's lighted weapon pointed at the floor inside a small pantry closet. A trap door. Salvio tore it open and pulled out his pistol, activated the tac light on the barrel. "Gallardo, Herman, with me," Salvio ordered, as he dropped into the darkened tunnel. Salvio and the others returned to the kitchen entrance empty-handed. The tunnel ran 70 or so meters to an empty outbuilding. The terrorists must have fled from there, out of sight of his sniper team. Salvio checked in with the chopper pilots on his comms, all deploying night vision and thermal imaging. "See anything?" "No, sir, not even a rabbit." "Damn it." He was supposed to report the capture of the two terrorists to the Comandante Mayor as soon as it happened. The old man would be pissed. All he had in his hands at the moment was his own swinging dick. Not exactly what HQ was hoping for. Salvio barked orders. He'd tear the place apart for intelligence. Maybe come away with something to show for their efforts. They ripped through the house front to back, flipping mattresses, tossing drawers, pulling rugs, tearing up floorboards. The place looked like a debris field after a tornado. Somebody had been here. Trash and butts on the floor. A filthy, unflushed toilet. But not one shred of intel to bring back for a trophy. While his men stood around gulping water from their hydration packs and scarfing down protein bars, Salvio called his pilots, ordering them to land for exfil. Might as well get back to barracks at Ciudad Evita and call it a night. 10 minutes later, his unit's three Eurocopters touched down, their turbines slowed. His men ducked low to avoid the carbon fiber rotors raking the air just above their heads and piled into the choppers. They made room for the sniper and his spotter, who'd had to hump in 6 clicks by foot the day before to avoid detection. The sniper grabbed a spot on the floor at Salvio's feet. At least the men were in good spirits, Salvio told himself. They laughed and joked among themselves as young men do for release after the adrenaline rush of a combat operation. Even one where no shots were fired. Ready, Ensign? The pilot asked. Let's get back to the barn, Salvio said in English, just like his instructor at Fort Benning used to say. Rapido! Salvio's son, a striker, was finally starting on his football team. With any luck, the refuel would go fast and he'd make it home in time to catch his game. The turbines whined as the choppers lifted in unison, arcing into the warm, starlit sky, streaking for home in single file. A heartbeat later, alarms screamed. Missile lock. Salvio grabbed a handhold as the helicopter plunged violently to escape, blowing autochaff in a steep banking turn. Through the gunner's door, he saw a fiery streak slam into one of his choppers and erupt in a cloud of flaming metal. The last thing Salvio heard was the roar of the exploding heat charge that tore his aircraft apart, killing most, including him. The screaming survivors perished when the burning wreck slammed into the ground 500 meters below. In the space of 30 seconds, the entire Scorpion platoon ceased to exist. Proof of concept number one. Chapter 2. Crisfield, Maryland. Jack pulled up to the curbless street in front of the modest one-story white frame house and killed the engine. It brought back memories. He hadn't been here since his freshman year in college, when Corey's mom cooked the two Georgetown students a roast. Stick to your ribs food, Jack. That's what you boys need if you're sailing today, she'd said. Taking the skiff Corey's dad built out onto Doherty Creek was one of Jack's favorite memories. Corey's working-class family was a lot like that little house. Solid, sturdy, dependable, and certainly nothing fancy. But Corey had been a good friend, and the memories Jack had from the summer road trip they took in their sophomore year, hiking 14ers in Colorado, still made him laugh. Jack approached the front door with trepidation. He hadn't seen Corey in years. Always meant to, but they both got busy. When his father died in his junior year, Corey gave up his dream of law school and dropped out of Georgetown to take over his father's hardware store and to care for his ailing mother. Jack made it out a few times that year, but Corey was too tied up with customers and inventory to really do anything but shoot the bull over coffee at the store. Jack's academic plate was also overflowing. No hard feelings, just a fork in the road. They went their separate ways. Jack found his dream job with Hendley Associates and the campus. Corey stocked lumber and bird food. Corey's mother died a few years back, but Jack missed that funeral. He didn't even know about it until the year after she was buried. He meant to call Corey and offer his condolences, but it just felt too damn awkward after so much time had passed. Yeah, awkward. Some friend asshole. Jack rang the doorbell. A moment later, a smartly dressed middle-aged nurse in blue scrubs opened the door. Jack noticed her lapel pins. Mary Frances was an RN and a nun. She smiled. You must be Jack. Corey's expecting you. Thank you, sister. Jack followed her through the neat and tidy home, the old wooden floors creaking under his 200-pound muscled frame. How's he doing? Jack whispered, as if in church. As well as can be expected, she replied at full voice. It won't be long now. He followed her down a narrow hallway. A dozen family photos in cheap frames hung on the walls. One of them was a picture of Jack and Corey standing next to that skiff so many years ago. Ouch. This way, the nun said, pushing open a bedroom door. An invitation for him to enter alone. Jack halted for a second. He would have felt more comfortable charging blind into a Tora Bora cave with an empty pistol than dealing with what he imagined was waiting for him inside. "Jack, you came." Corey smiled broadly, sitting up in his adjustable bed. He held out his hand. Despite the pallid skin and skeletal frame, he exuded warmth and grace. Jack sighed with relief. He crossed the room and took Corey's soft hand. Jack was 6'1" and powerfully built, more so now than when they were in school together. But back then, Corey had been 6'4" and 220, a state champion lacrosse player, a real beast. Hard to believe the frail wraith in the adjustable bed had once carried a 175-pound Jack 1.5 miles down a Colorado slope on his back after he twisted his ankle. Now Corey was half his former weight, if that, and could barely hold up his own arm. "Good to see you, Cor.
Sorry for the long drive out. I know you're a busy guy."
Ouch. Again. Corey saw the flinch.
"Sorry, I didn't mean it that way. I know working for a financial firm like Hendley Associates must be an 80-hour-a-week job.
Sometimes I bring a cot to the office. Better to sleep than commute."
"Good for you."
Corey lay back on his elevated bed, obviously fatigued by his efforts. Jack glanced around the room while Corey got comfortable, adjusting the IV needle taped to the back of his bruised and sallow hand. A large crucifix hung on the wall opposite the foot of his bed. Next to it was a framed wedding photo of his parents. Corey was an only child. Standing next to the bottles of pain meds was a framed novena, Our Lady of Good Remedy. A rolling IV stand with a bag stood on the far side of the bed.
"So, I like what you've done with the place," Jack said. "My designer calls it medical modern. Sort of like Mad Men, but with drugs instead of booze.
I need to call her."
"Just wait a few more weeks. I know a place where you'll be able to get all of this stuff dirt cheap."
Corey winked. Jack chuckled. He never knew anybody funnier than Corey. Or scarier when he threw a punch. Fists like cinder blocks tied to tree trunks. Two bikers in a Jackson Hole bar discovered that side of Corey the hard way. Jack suddenly felt very self-conscious, his full beard and head of hair in stark contrast to Corey's naked scalp. Chemo took that thick mane of curly blonde hair, no doubt, but not the fire in those dark brown eyes. Corey reached for a plastic cup full of ice water, but it was too far away. Jack snatched it up and brought it close.
"Thanks."
Corey sipped cool water through the straw. Jack's eyes drifted back to the prayer card. "Dear Lady of Good Remedy, source of unfailing help, thy compassionate heart knows a remedy for every affliction."
"You go to church much, Jack?"
"Me? Not enough. You?"
"Kinda hard to wheel this bed down the aisle these days. But I do have my own nun, don't I?"
Jack glanced back at the large crucifix. He thought about the co-eds that used to draw to Corey like flies to honey, and the beer kegs he'd polished off almost single-handedly.
"I guess you got some religion lately."
"No, I got some cancer lately. My faith renewed is the payoff."
"That's great," Jack said. Corey heard the cynicism in Jack's voice.
"Yeah, I know. Foxhole prayers and all of that. But I'm serious. There's something about facing your mortality that brings eternal things into focus."
"Sure. I suppose it would." Jack didn't mention he'd stared death in the face a few times lately. Quite a few times. He had a hard time finding faith in the dark abyss of a pistol barrel shoved in his face.
"Don't be like me and wait until something like this wakes you up.
Now you sound like my sister."
"I liked your sister. She doing okay?"
"A doctor now, just like Mom. Same hospital, even. Married a great guy."
"Good for her.
Your folks okay? I don't watch the news much these days.
They're doing well. Thanks for asking. Corey coughed violently. Thick gobs of phlegm rattled in his throat. He lurched forward, gasping for breath, his pale face reddening with the effort. Jack reached for a clean spit tray on the table and held it up to Corey's lips with one hand while supporting his bony back with the other. Corey coughed and spat until a spoonful of yellow gel finally dropped into the pink plastic tray. The nurse burst into the room. Corey? She rushed over to the bed as Jack gently lowered him. She took the spit tray from Jack's hand and set it down.
Thank you, Jack. Perhaps you can wait outside for a minute, she said as she wiped Corey's mouth with a tissue.
Sure, no problem.
Corey shook his head and waved a frail hand.
No, wait, Jack. I'm fine.
You sure? I've got plenty of time.
Corey took another sip of water with the nun's help. It surprised Jack how much effort it took him. He finished and sighed with exhaustion.
I'll be right outside, the nun said. But call me before you need me, okay?
Corey smiled.
Okay.
She left, closing the door gently behind her.
So, Jack, remember those 14ers we climbed in Colorado?
Sure do.
I was thinking about that when I pulled up. Good times, man. Can't tell you how often I thought about those days when I was counting pallets of drywall and roofing nails. Got me through some dark patches.
Guilt fell all over Jack like a bucket of warm motor oil.
I'm sorry about that, Corey. I should have... Oh, man, no. I wasn't saying anything. I just mean climbing those mountains meant a lot to me. That high up. Clean air. And quiet.
Yeah, good times for sure.
I've had a lot of time to think about my life lying here, you know. Things done and things undone. And to be honest with you, I wouldn't change a lot. Don't get me wrong. Arguing a landmark case in front of the Supreme Court would have been awesome. But it wasn't meant to be.
It must have been hard on you.
It was, and it wasn't. I just did what I had to do to take care of my family. You would have done the same thing for yours. I know you would have.
Jack nodded. He sure as hell would have. There wasn't anything he wouldn't do for his family, especially his mom and dad.
So really, no regrets.
Well,
except one. I never told you this, but I made two promises to my dad when he was on his deathbed. I'm proud to say I kept one of them, finishing my pre-law degree at Georgetown last year.
That's freaking awesome. Congratulations. Jack stuck out his hand. Corey took it as best as he could.
Thanks, man. Summa cum laude, too, by the way.
Not surprised. Truth was, Corey was the sharpest knife in the drawer.
But I didn't keep the other promise. And it's killing me.
You do look like shit. But I thought that was the cancer, Jack said, hoping for a laugh. He got one.
Ouch, man, Corey said, touching his stomach. Don't do that. It makes me hurt.
Sorry.
No, you're not. No, not really.
They bumped fists. Friends again. For life.
However long that was.
So, what's the promise you didn't keep? Corey told him. Jack didn't bat an eye.
It's a lot to ask. I know, Corey said. But I couldn't think of anyone else I could ask, let alone pull it off. But I hate to disappoint my dad, you know?
Yeah, I know. But I think he'd understand.
He probably would. But this is about me. I want to keep my word. And you're my only shot.
Jack fought back, the tears welling up in his eyes.
it would be an honor.
Sister Mary Frances brought in a bottle of 12-year-old Macallan's single malt whiskey and two glasses Corey had purchased for the occasion. The bedridden man sipped water out of his glass while Jack worked his way through a couple fingers. They laughed and told stories like old college buddies do. But the light began to dim outside, and Corey's eyes began fluttering with fatigue. Jack left the room with Corey gently snoring, and Sister Mary Frances's heartfelt thanks.
If he needs anything at all, please call me, Jack said, slipping her a business card.
She handed him one of hers as well.
I will. Safe travels, Jack. And God bless you for coming.
Jack was surprised when his phone rang with her number just 3.5 hours later as he sat at his desk, poring over a spreadsheet. Corey Chase was gone.
Chapter 3. Washington, D.C., Russell Senate Office Building. Arnie Van Dam, President Ryan's chief of staff, sat in the office of Senator Deborah Dixon. There was something bigger than the massive, hand-carved antique desk separating them at the moment. As the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and a former chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee on Europe and Regional Security Cooperation, Dixon was one of the most powerful people in the Senate, and arguably the most important foreign policy legislator. Treaties lived and died on her watch. Except this time, a bill didn't die. It was killed, shot in the head and bled out by Dixon herself, a fellow Republican. It had been a straight party-line vote, except for Dixon, who crossed the aisle and voted with the Democrats. Arnie was furious. More important, so was President Ryan, along with Secretary of State Scott Adler, Secretary of Defense Robert Burgess, and the Army Chief of Staff. President Ryan himself had spent months carefully planning and negotiating a bilateral treaty with Poland to build and maintain a permanent army base on Polish soil. That base would serve as a forward defense against encroaching Russian expansion in the region, in the face of a weakening Western European commitment to NATO's defense. As chief of staff, Arnie had the task of greasing the wheels on Capitol Hill for any piece of legislation, including the one Dixon murdered. The senator was an old friend and a reliable colleague. Or so he thought until this morning. He polished his steel-rimmed glasses, trying to calm himself.
You're kind of cute when you're angry, Arnie. Anyone ever tell you that? Dixon said.
She was 56, trying to look 36, and nearly pulling it off. Pilates 5 times a week, Botox 3 times a year, a strict paleo diet, and the best hair colorist in the district went a long way. But good genetics didn't hurt. She was a striking woman, but it was her razor-sharp mind and not her head-turning figure that got her where she was today.
Well, mostly.
If you think I'm cute when I'm angry, then I must be damned beautiful right now, Deborah. A fucking Adonis. I thought we had a deal.
Arnie's bald scalp pinked with anger.
Well, you thought wrong. We had a lengthy discussion, and I considered your words carefully.
The subcommittee examined the matter from all points, including expert testimony both for and against.
You know, Arnie, I do have a job to do. I'm a sitting U.S. senator, not a GOP apparatchik. I'm supposed to advise and consent, not just roll over and wag my tail whenever the Ryan administration whistles.
Cute speech, Deborah. You write it yourself?
Let's cut the shit, Arnie. What do you want?
To begin with, I want a public apology. You embarrassed the hell out of the president. He's already scheduled for a meeting with the Polish president in Warsaw next month to break ground on the base.
First of all, I'm not apologizing for living up to my sworn constitutional responsibilities. And second, don't blame me because you already ordered your golden shovels for Fort Ryan.
Damn it, Deborah, that's not fair and you know it. No one's asking you to shirk your duties. But if you had concerns, you should have brought them to us privately, and we could have worked something out. But you know that, and you didn't say a thing. What the hell happened?
Nothing happened, Arnie, other than I performed due diligence.
And what did your due diligence uncover that we hadn't already discussed ad nauseam?
Come on, Arnie. We're adults here. Let's get real. This is rah-rah bullshit. A giant photo op. This treaty sends exactly the wrong message at the wrong time to the Russians. It's time to de-escalate, especially with a new Russian president. Give him a chance to settle in. Putting a forward base on his perimeter forces him to respond. Otherwise, the Kremlin hardliners will have his head, literally, if not figuratively.
Si vis pacem parabellum, Arnie said, leaning in. If you want peace, prepare for war.
Si vis pacem para pacem, she countered. We should try diplomacy for a change, instead of provocation.
We're not the aggressors here. We aren't the ones who put troops over the borders in Ukraine and Lithuania.
Arnie was referring to the recent Russian incursions, pushed back or at least halted by a force of mostly American arms.
But you know that. What's this really all about?
I think I've made myself perfectly clear. This bilateral treaty, which is already pissing off our most important NATO allies, Germany and France, isn't going to do anything but provoke another war with the Russians. We keep encroaching on their periphery, despite our promises to the contrary.
The Russians are just making excuses. No, Arnie. Think about it from their perspective. The Russians agreed to allow Germany to reunify, but only after a NATO promise not to expand eastward. What happened? Germany unified, Russia's worst strategic fear, at least on the continent, and NATO expanded eastward anyway. That was before President Ryan's time. But he still stands by it. It's not like he's pulling back our NATO commitments in the east. Croatia? Albania? For Christ's sakes, Arnie, Montenegro! You think we need Montenegro for strategic defense in depth? Don't bother to answer that. We both know the answer. So do the Russians. You're one of the president's whiz kids. Tell me, what would you do if you were the Russians and the shoe were on the other foot?
I sure as hell wouldn't be invading my neighbors.
Really? If Cuba suddenly got nuclear weapons, or the Russians staged bear bombers on bases in Canada, you'd advise the president to be patient, to not see any of that as a threat.
But we're not the Russians.
Russians. Dixon shook her head in a pitying gesture. What is it with you neocons and Russia? It's a glorified gas station with nukes that they'll never use. A third-rate power at best. Tell me, Deborah, what's the color of the sky in your world? Because in mine, it's blue. And in my world, the Russians are an aggressive and dangerous nuclear power that won't stop expanding unless someone stops them. The Germans sure as hell aren't going to do it. The Poles will, or at least help us stop them.
Our current defense budget is 10 times larger than Russia's, and larger than the combined defense spending of the next 8 countries, including Russia and China. Hell, our defense budget is 3 times larger than the rest of NATO combined. You think one more American base in Poland will finally do the trick?
Arnie sighed. We used to be on the same page. I don't quite get you. So tell me, straight up, what do you want?
What do I want?
Dixon stood. I'll tell you what I want. A bourbon and rocks. You want one too? She crossed over to her office minibar. As Dixon dropped ice in her glass, Arnie rubbed his head, thinking, what's her game? He scanned the walls absentmindedly. He'd seen the photos before. Dixon with kings and presidents, popes and CEOs. In one, she knelt by the bedside of a double amputee at Walter Reed. In another, she sat in the cockpit of an F-35. And in a third, her eyes were glued to the periscope of a Los Angeles-class attack submarine. There were also photos of projects in Africa and around the world, paid for by the Dixon Gage Charitable Trust. The wall of photos said it all. She was an effective legislator, a compassionate leader, a foreign policy expert, and, to judge from her tailored Fendi suit and Manolo Blahnik estipulants, a woman of expensive tastes married to big money. She was, in a word, ambitious. Dixon took her seat behind her desk and sipped her bourbon.
Where were we?
I need you to know that this will not stand. President Ryan is determined to get this treaty passed. He reached out to you before, and now you've bitten his hand. That's a stupid mistake, especially for someone who has her eyes on the prize. Dixon snorted. Hell, Arnie. I once caught a White House janitor sitting in the president's chair. Everybody in this town has their eyes on the prize. The question is, what would any of them do with it if they actually got a hold of it? Defend the nation from all enemies, foreign and domestic, or so I hope. At least we agree on something. The devil is in the details. Look, Deborah, you want to run for president? Fine. But you're better off with a Ryan endorsement than without one. Is that something you're guaranteeing today? Arnie shook his head. You know I can't do that. The president will endorse whom he thinks is the best man or woman for the job. Then the choice is clear, don't you think? Running for the presidency against this president's agenda is a mistake, especially the president of your own party. You know I've never been a party hack. I'm an independent thinker. Then you can run as an independent. And lose? No, thank you. I need the GOP nomination if I want to win. Then mind your manners, wait your turn, and get in line with the president's agenda. Dixon's face visibly reddened behind the bleached white smile. I'll take that under advisement. Good. And consider the consequences if you don't. Arnie stood. I've got another meeting, Senator. Thank you for your time. He turned on his heel and left, not waiting for her response. Dixon sat back in her chair, rolling the bourbon glass in her fingers, fuming. President Ryan was pissed off. She knew he would be. But that was part of the price she was willing to pay. Besides, she had no choice. On the Polish treaty, her instructions were made crystal clear. And she had no intentions of waiting her turn. She sipped her bourbon thoughtfully. The idea of Ryan coming after her sent shivers down her spine. But the alternative was far worse. Chapter 4. Tehran, Iran, Ministry of Intelligence and Security, Vivak. Satisfied? Dr. Mehdi Mohammadi, head of Vivak, Iran's intelligence ministry, had been staring at that single word query on the computer screen for more than a minute. It was an interesting question, full of possibilities and dangers. The countdown clock didn't help clarify matters. 42 seconds to go. Sir? The bearded young technician smiled hopefully. He liked his job. He liked breathing even better. Crossing Dr. Mohammadi threatened both. I'm still thinking. Mohammadi stroked his gray beard with his one good hand. In truth, he was satisfied. The intel provided by Chibi was as good as promised. Perhaps too good. On the one hand, it had allowed the Quds force to set a trap and wipe out the Argentine crusaders, opening the door for further Hezbollah actions in that country and, perhaps, the entire subcontinent, providing yet another distraction for the Americans and Israelis in a war they could never win against the Most High. 30 seconds, sir. Even with one blinded eye, I can still read a clock. Vivak. Vezarate Etelaat va Amniat e Keshvar was the largest, most powerful, and best-funded agency in Iran, and Dr. Mohammadi reported only to the supreme leader, Ayatollah Yasseri. Even the Assembly of Experts had no say in his affairs. His agency was second only to Mossad in the region, and nearly equal to the other great power services. Intelligence was key to everything. His unknown soldiers of Imam Zaman carried out clandestine intelligence-gathering operations all over the globe. But never had they gathered this kind of intelligence. The kind of intelligence that would change everything. Intelligence of inestimable value. And how did Chibi come by it? A single anonymous email. His best technicians still couldn't trace the source, with a simple offer. A free sample, it promised. Mohammadi's first thought was that it was a trap. Some kind of elaborate ruse by the Americans or Israelis to expose Quds Force and Hezbollah operations in Latin America. But even the Americans wouldn't sacrifice more than 24 Argentine special operators for an act of deception. This all seemed too good to be true. But Allah was known to confound the minds of the infidels. And every intelligence professional knew that the greatest intelligence coups of the Cold War didn't come from traditional methods, but rather through persons choosing to walk in the door and deliver the goods of their own volition, motivated by their own sense of ideology, ego, or greed. Was this the case now? Or was this indeed an elaborate and bloody trap designed to finally destroy the revolution? And if so, by whom? The Persian spring operation had been an utter fiasco. Thanks be to Allah that he had opposed it from the start, Mohammadi thought. But that fool Ghorbani had won the argument. His death was Allah's judgment, surely. But the Russians were badly burned by the failed operation. Perhaps they were seeking some sort of revenge for Reza Kazem's failure. If Mohammadi passed on this opportunity, he risked losing the greatest sword Allah could ever have put in his hands to defeat his crusader enemies. Perhaps Allah would not forgive him if he foolishly refused the generous offer. The Ayatollah surely would not forgive him if he refused it. Mohammadi cast his one eye, not blinded by the Shah's Savak torturers, at the technician seated next to him. Did the young man realize his life hung in the balance of the next few seconds? There was another possibility. Could this be the devil's sword, aimed at the heart of the Republic? A sword plucked out from the fires of hell by his own hand, because he had allowed himself to be deceived by the infidel on the other end of this computer connection. Risk versus reward. Isn't that how the Americans would view this? Dr. Mohammadi touched the knot of fused bone and melted flesh that used to be his left hand. Another gift of the CIA and Mossad-trained Savak scum that tried to strangle the revolution in its mother's womb. His hatred for the Americans and Jews knew no bounds. Allah had used his suffering to make him as hard as the stump at the end of his arm. His study of the holy texts taught him many things, but none so important as the truth that there are no cowards in paradise. Just 4 seconds left on the clock. Type, yes, quite satisfied, Mohammadi finally said. The tech sighed silently and typed quickly. They worked in English, the language chosen by Chibi. When he was still a young Islamic scholar, Mohammadi fled to Canada to escape the Shah's murderous reach. He became fluent in both French and English in his years there before Savak found him and brought him back to Tehran for extensive interrogation. Another proof of Allah's omniscient guidance in his life. Now ask, how much? The tech typed again. A response appeared instantly. You know the terms. Name your price, Mohammadi replied. You know the terms. At least tell me whom I'm bidding against. Mohammadi feared that someone else would win the auction and wield this weapon against the Republic. But he also feared paying too much. Iran's economy was in shambles now.
He would have to ask the Ayatollah for ungodly sums of money if he wanted to guarantee a win. But what if the other bidders were lesser agencies? You know the terms. Clearly, Chibi was being careful. Syntax, vocabulary, and logical arguments could give away his identity. Enemies of the revolution. You know the terms. He did. Anonymity of the bidders had been guaranteed. But the other bidders must be the other major intelligence agencies locked in battle with the Americans. Who else would want what Chibi was selling? Yes or no? Yes. I will send a representative to London on the date specified. Instructions to follow. Chibi disappeared from the screen. Another digital djinn in the wilderness of the dark web. A quick, cold look from Mohammadi's blinded eye sent the tech scurrying out of the air-conditioned room. The intelligence chief sat alone in the underground bunker, surrounded by the hum of a dozen large-screen monitors, rubbing his stump and thinking. Chibi was a genius. A single silent bid in an anonymous auction would guarantee maximum profit. If Chibi offered the same quality free sample to the others as had been offered to him, they would all be champing at the bit and bidding high. Time to meet with the supreme leader. He stood, brushing away the wrinkles in his clerical robe. With the economy in shambles, it would take some effort to gather the vast sum he had in mind. Priceless didn't come cheap. Inshallah. Chapter 5. Fort Meade, Maryland, NSA Headquarters. Dead rats. Sometimes pigeons. But dead, desiccated rats were better. We slathered them with hot sauce to keep the feral cats away and stuffed film rolls or transposition ciphers in them for dead drops. That was how we did it in Moscow back in the day. So said Director of National Intelligence Mary Pat Foley, sitting at the head of a large mahogany table in the fourth floor conference room. Her husband, Ed Foley, had been the youngest CIA Moscow chief of station ever. They served together, brought and raised their kids over there. It was the late 80s. It was the Cold War. It was a long time ago. Mary Pat glanced around the room. Polite smiles, mostly. Indulging the boss, no doubt. The faces were all so young. 40s, mostly. A few even younger. On either side of her sat the security department head or their representative from each of the 16 agencies that comprised the intelligence community, IC, Cloud, as well as the rep from her own office, the ODNI. The room's glass walls were electronically shaded from the dozens of NSA analysts at their workstations on the floor beyond. Total security all around. She used to be the youngest person in every room. More often these days, she was the oldest. When did that happen? She thought. One fleeting day at a time. The youngest face in the room sat directly opposite her on the far end of the table. Amanda Watson was also the most attractive. Blonde and athletically built, the 33-year-old computer savant looked more like a Fox News anchor than CloudServe's senior design engineer and principal architect of the IC Cloud. Watson was also in charge of IC Cloud security and personally ran the Red Team hacking group that routinely assaulted the IC Cloud, searching for any hardware or software weak spots to exploit. Who better to do this than the woman who had designed the world's first unhackable cloud network? Rats? Sounds kind of gross, Watson said, flashing a perfectly engineered smile. But I'm guessing it worked. Like a charm. Foley scanned the room again. She was trying to find a way to make her point. The average technical IQ around the table was several orders of magnitude beyond hers, especially Watson's. Who was she to challenge these brainiacs?
The decision to put all IC intelligence onto a single cloud, really just racks and racks of servers in a secured data storage facility, was made by people smarter than she was, and who assured both her and President Ryan that this was the future of intelligence processing, sharing, and security. No more firewalls or turf wars that prevented one federal agency from knowing vital information that another agency had. No more missed opportunities. No more FUBARs. Everything the IC departments did, ELINT, HUMINT, and SIGINT, was uploaded to the cloud. Everyone had access. Everyone would be on the same page. It was exponentially more efficient for information sharing among all IC agencies and organizations, rendered enormous cost savings, and increased computer security by reducing the number and complexity of machines and access nodes. On paper, it was a brilliant idea, and all of it more secure than ever before. Or so they said. As one of her aides explained to her, instead of having a bunch of little banks scattered all over the country, where every local bank robber had a chance to break into any one of them, now you had a giant Fort Knox where all the money was kept. And nobody could break into Fort Knox. Right? Rats were great because nobody likes rats, not even communists, especially dead rats dropped around garbage cans. Watson's flawless brow furrowed with an unspoken question. And your point is? You all are digital natives, Foley said. You grew up with this stuff like a second language. You're fluent in Hadoop nodes and BitLockers and SAS. My generation are digital palms. Palms, ma'am? The young analyst from the FBI intelligence branch asked. Palms. Pomegranates. Rhymes with immigrants? It's an Aussie word I picked up recently. It's a tiresome way for me to say I'm a digital immigrant. I came to all of this late. I know it's the future. Heck, it's the now. But I'm analog. I know what works for me. I assure you, Madam Director, the IC cloud works too. Watson didn't pile on. They'd just spent the last 2 hours reviewing the stunning successes of the system in today's quarterly meeting. Perfect operability, zero breaches. Foley touched her tablet. I know it does. Your data proves it. But you're still concerned, Watson said. She was the only private sector person in the room, and her company's future depended on making and keeping her federal government clients happy. A professional habit, Foley offered with a weary smile. She hadn't been sleeping well lately. Another hazard in her line of work. What was really bothering her? Was it her own insecurity she was worried about? Unable to keep up completely with all of the technobabble? Just feeling her age? It was easy to dismiss someone as young and pretty as Watson. Women Foley's age often did, for all of the wrong reasons. Youth and beauty were still the coin of the realm. But that would be a mistake. Foley had studied Watson's file. She was, without question, brilliant. What had made Watson particularly interesting to the Ryan administration was her unreserved patriotism, a lamentably rare thing in the privileged corporate boardrooms of the San Francisco Bay Area. Amanda's brother, Kyle Rex Watson, was a Delta sniper, killed by an 82-millimeter mortar strike along with his spotter Mutt in Sevastopol just a few years ago, during the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Since his death, Watson had worked tirelessly on behalf of wounded veterans and their families, winning numerous awards for her charitable work. Mary Pat's sources told her that Watson even visited his grave at Arlington National Cemetery before today's meeting. No one in the room doubted Watson's skill sets, intelligence, or patriotism, least of all Foley. But it wasn't Watson that Foley was worried about. A few years ago, China's premier cyber warfare unit, Ghost Ship, had been destroyed in a heroic bombing run by Marine Corps fighter pilots on the Chinese mainland. But China's electronic warfare and cyber espionage cadres, including the infamous People's Liberation Army Unit 61398, had only expanded in numbers and capabilities in recent years. It wasn't a surprise. China produced more than 4 million STEM graduates every year on the mainland, and many thousands of STEM students in the United States were actually Chinese nationals, some of whom were guilty of spying on the U.S. corporations and research institutions that hired them. American corporations lost an estimated $300 billion of intellectual property to China's cyber espionage programs, which had also successfully stolen plans related to advanced American weapons systems, including the F-35 Lightning II. Chinese Army's APT, Advanced Persistent Threat Units, have upped their game recently, investing heavily in AI-assisted hacking attacks that are escalating exponentially in frequency and scope. Tell me, Ms. Watson, doesn't that concern you? Yes, of course it does. China is, without a doubt, the single greatest cybersecurity threat we face. But right behind them are the Russians, the North Koreans, the Iranians. The list is endless. The IC Cloud's standardized, automated, and air-gapped cloud computing system has proven to be impervious to their attacks, as I know you're well aware, Madam Director. But here's what's keeping me up at night, Amanda, Foley began. All U.S. intelligence is stored and analyzed on the IC Cloud. But the USIC is intimately connected to the Five Eyes program, the Club de Berne, and EU INTSEN, among others. In short, the entire Western intelligence apparatus would be exposed if the IC Cloud was ever compromised. I can't shake the feeling that having put all of our eggs in this one basket has created an awfully tempting target. The math isn't on our side. The IC is currently defeating tens of millions of attacks every year, and I congratulate all of you around this table for that. But if just one of them succeeds, just one, we could suffer the most catastrophic intelligence failure in the history of the world. Watson nodded patiently. Forgive me, but I think the math actually is on our side. I would suggest that the failure of tens of millions of these attacks so far this year is evidence that the IC Cloud is doing its job perfectly, and there is every reason to believe it will continue to do so. Watson leaned back in her chair, tenting her fingers. Believe me, Madam Director, you're not the only one who wakes up with panic attacks in the middle of the night. That's why my red team hackers work so hard to find any potential vulnerabilities. My department is constantly updating your hardware and software, and there isn't a line of code or a single circuit diagram upgrade that doesn't land on my desk. I check and double-check everything after it's all been thoroughly tested by my team. The best in the world, I might add. To borrow a quote, you have nothing to fear but fear itself. You sound pretty confident. I can't guarantee the sun will rise tomorrow morning either. But I believe the IC Cloud is just as reliable. Watson leaned forward on the table. I love this country too much to put it at risk. If there is ever a whiff of a potential problem, you will be the first to know, Madam Director. You have my word on that. Watson smiled warmly. Until then, leave the worrying to me. Foley offered a tired nod. She came in wanting assurances. Watson gave her at least a few. I'll do my best. I suppose I have enough on my plate as it is. Foley addressed the room. Again, thank you all for your time and attention. She stood. Especially to you, Ms. Watson. And please give my regards to Elias. Meeting adjourned. As the others began filing out, Watson asked, "A private word, if I may?" Foley smiled. Of course. The room emptied. Amanda Watson approached Foley. Both remained standing after hours of sitting through the long session. Foley admired the younger woman. She'd studied her security audit files closely. Watson was recruited heavily by Silicon Valley firms out of grad school at UC Berkeley, where she earned her master's degree in computer engineering, graduating at the top of her class at the tender age of 18. The head of the NSA had personally flown out to the West Coast to invite her into the fold after Watson passed a secret FBI vetting with flying colors. But she turned him down cold for the far more lucrative offer made by Elias Dom, seduced by both the cash and the Playboy's well-known sexual charisma. The two lovers went on to build the world's largest and most trusted cloud computing company over the course of the next decade. A brilliant engineer in his own right, Dom was the headline-grabbing salesman and Watson the quiet technical genius, an updated version of Apple's Jobs-Wozniak dynamic. After Elias Dom had moved on to other romantic and business interests, particularly SpaceServ, his rocket subsidiary, Watson kept a steady hand on the tiller at CloudServ's engineering department. Watson wasn't on the CloudServ board, but she was number four in the company's organizational chart, after Dom, the COO and CFO, respectively, and she owned approximately $240 million worth of CloudServ stock. It was as much her company as his, at least in intellectual pedigree, though not in legal reality. "How may I help you, Amanda?" "Just a quick word. Elias asked me to inquire about where we stood on the Jedi Warcloud project." Watson was referring to the Joint Enterprise Defense Infrastructure Program the DoD was seeking to implement. The Jedi Warcloud would consolidate the DoD's 400 data centers to just one integrated cloud-based system with real-time monitoring of all activities. The biggest tech names, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, were also bidding for the contract. But CloudServ had the inside track, thanks to its successful implementation of the IC Cloud. Watson wasn't a saleswoman, but she knew that part of her job today was to wax the skis for CloudServ's Jedi bid. "I'm sorry Elias couldn't be with us today," Foley said, hiding her annoyance. The federal government was CloudServ's biggest client, and they stood to gain even more business if the Warcloud project moved forward. "I apologize, Madam Director. The next SpaceServ launch is less than 2 weeks away, and it has his full attention. Besides," she grinned, "I'm a much better engineer than he is anyway. It made more sense for me to be at this meeting today. You and your team are doing a fantastic job, and I really do want you to know how much I appreciate all that you've accomplished, despite the hand-wringing you witnessed today. The entire IC is to be commended. You have some really top-drawer people running the show. But I promise you, we won't relax. You're absolutely right to worry about the Chinese and the rest of the bad guys out there. They're relentless. But so are we. Please convey my best wishes to Elias. I hope the launch goes well. And what may I tell him regarding our Warcloud bid? Tell him that all bids have been submitted and are being reviewed, just as the law requires." "Yes, of course. I'll do that." They shook hands. "Have a safe trip home, Amanda." Foley resisted the temptation to play mother and advise her that a schoolgirl crush on the high school quarterback was no way to organize one's life. Chapter 6. Berlin, Germany. Dieter Hansmann exited the Blisestrasse U-Bahn-Station, the last train of the night. He jammed his hands into his coat pockets against the slight chill breeze and headed south until he reached the Mexican restaurant on the corner and turned left onto his street. The late-night auditing marathons over the last month had become a predictable thing and had taken their toll on the 35-year-old banker. But it was worth it. He was close to finally nailing down the project he'd been assigned. Very close. Mature elm trees lined both sides of the narrow street, spreading their branches high over the asphalt, bent over and nearly touching, like the angel's wings on the Ark of the Covenant. A small fenced park stood on his side of the street, a pleasant place to jog when he actually had the time to do it. He looked forward to the day he'd be there again. He hoped before it began snowing in the next month or two. Passing by a park entrance gate, he heard a commotion, a woman's plaintive cry against a man's harsh, accented voice. Dieter stopped in his tracks and squinted through the gloom. The couple were little more than shadows in the distance, partially hidden from the street. The tall man raised an arm high before swinging it down with a curse in Arabic. Dieter hesitated. Nothing could put his work at risk. But honor won out in the space of a single breath, and the athletic German dashed toward the fighting couple. When he got close, he shouted, "Halt!" but kept at a dead run straight for the bigger man's broad torso. The woman, a redhead, cried out, "Hilf mir!" just as the bearded Araber backhanded her across the jaw. She tumbled to the ground in a whimper as the man whipped around, facing Dieter down with a crooked smile and a sharp blade. The banker didn't slow. He juked left, then right, forcing the other man, an Egyptian, to shift his weight. Dieter juked left again, and just at the moment when the bearded man transferred his weight between his feet, Dieter lunged forward with speed, blocking a weak strike by the other man with his left forearm and smashing his right elbow into the side of his skull. Dieter's strength and momentum put the man on his back, scattering the blade. The German's CQB training took over. Straddling the Egyptian between his thighs, Dieter pinned his neck to the ground with his left forearm as he launched right elbow strikes at his face, partially blocked by the bigger man's counterpunches. The German's furious attack ended with the explosion of white-hot pain in his back. Instinctively, he rose up and reached for the wound, only to feel the heavy knife blade plunge again between his shoulders, this time severing his spinal cord.